KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's second hour of Forum, we'll be joined by physicist Leonard Susskind, one of the originators of string theory, who has written a book designed for a lay audience all about what he calls the cosmic landscape and string theory and the illusion of intelligent design. He joins us for an hour that will include your calls and emails coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Leonard Susskind is considered by many to be the founder of string theory, and he is one of its leading practitioners, as well as a physicist who has done advanced work on quarks and black holes. String theory, which was thought to provide unity to quantum mechanics and relativity, is based on the notion that all the varied particles and forces in the universe are made up of wriggling strands, tiny elastic loops, or strings of energy, dependent entirely on the mode of their vibration. The latest version of this theory has come to be called M-theory, which has no single physics model, but rather about 10,500, give or take a few trillion. Leonard Susskind sees these 10,500 as corresponding to another universe, or potential universe, as real as our own, and he calls it calls these potential environments the landscape. All the possible universes are known as the megaverse. And all this would appear to go against the idea of intelligent design. Yet Leonard Susskind, who takes on intelligent design in his most recent book, supports the anthropic principle, the notion that our universe is the right one for our human biology. Leonard Susskind has been Felix Bloch Professor in Theoretical Physics at Stanford since 1978 and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His recently published book is called The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design, and he joins us for this morning's second hour. I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you, Michael. May I correct you?
Please.
Yes, I know you said 10,500. I know where that comes from. It comes over the email. When you write an email 10 to the 500, it comes out as 10,500. 10 to the 500 is a much, 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 much bigger number than 10.
I did say 10,500.
Yes, you did.
Thank you for that correction. Yeah, 10 to the 500 indeed, and thank you so much. Let's talk first, if we can, about string theory, since you're kind of called the father of it and all that. I know you've been humble on that score, but it's deserved. Challenges to it. Now, you know, being challenged left and right, ill-defined, based on crude assumptions. Tell us.
You're talking probably about some of the books and blogs that have come out in very, very big criticism of mm-hmm. it. Well, I think one would have to say that some of it is due to a certain kind of grumpiness of people who, well, for example, there's one fellow who failed as a physicist, never made it as a physicist, became a computer programmer, has been angry all his life that he never became a physicist and that physicists ignore him. And so he's now taking out his revenge by writing diatribes and polemics against string theory. There's another fellow who has his own theory. I won't tell you who his name is or what his theory is, but he writes lots and lots of theories, and his theories go glub, 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 glub to the bottom of the sea before he even gets a chance to put them out there. Physicists don't take him seriously. He's angry, and so he's also writing a book complaining about how string theorists are a priesthood of scientists who are taking over science, absconding with all of its funding, and trying to take over the whole world of science. Now, if you believe that, you'll believe that Elvis Presley can be found in Tora Bora.
Reminds me of those who were concerned about, well, actually a number of things come to mind. When research money goes to a certain kind of theory, it seems to stir up all kinds of a hornet's nest. But there has been this M theory that I mentioned in my introduction, right, that has
yes.
come to kind of replace or supplant maybe to some extent string theory? No.
I wouldn't say it's come to supplant it. It's a particular version of it. What was found was that all of the various different string theories, and there were lots of them, there were lots and lots of different versions of string theory, all fit into one particular kind of mathematical theory of which they are found to be solutions of that particular theory. In other words, what's happening in string theory is what was once thought to be lots of different theories is turning out to be lots of solutions, lots of mathematical solutions of the same theory. What is that same theory? Well, it can be called M-theory. It could be called lots of different names. But M-theory is simply the name for a theory which is bigger than string theory and which contains all the different kinds of string theories. So, and I don't even know what M stands for.
I don't think anybody does, do they?
Well, the person who invented the word M-theory was Ed Witten, and I've asked him on an occasion, what does M stand for, Ed? And he said, he don't know.
I just gave it a letter. Let's talk about so much of what you write about here has to do with the cosmological constant, also with the anthroid principle. And let's talk first about the former. Most perplexing question in physics, you call it.
Yes, I think it is. And I don't think there's any controversy about this. There's a number in physics. It was invented or discovered, shall we say, by Albert Einstein. You know Newton's formula for gravity. Newton's formula for gravity says everything attracts each other as the square of the distance between things proportional to the product of the masses. Einstein discovered in his own equations that there was another term, a kind of repulsive gravity. Very, very weak. It could be very weak or it could be very strong. Einstein put it into his equations. It was consistent with his equations. And what he thought is that it could balance the effect of gravity pulling things together so that the universe could maintain itself without just contracting. Well, he soon became disabused of it. But the problem is once you open Pandora's box, once you say this thing could exist, a cosmological constant is consistent with the equations, you then have to explain if it's not there, why it's not there. And physicists were never able to explain why this little bit of repulsive gravity wasn't there. The one thing they knew about it is that whatever it was incredibly tiny, because if it wasn't tiny, it would have affected the astronomical motions of galaxies, of clusters of galaxies, and in fact, that it would have prevented the repulsion of this cosmological constant, would have prevented stars, galaxies, planets, and all the ordinary things of astronomy from ever forming. Objects formed because gravity pulled them together. If there was a cosmological constant repelling things, it would have prevented them from ever forming. And so the only thing that we know about this cosmological constant, why it's so small, is because if it was any bigger, we wouldn't be here to ask the question.
It's the whole delicate balance, then, of the universe.
It's incredibly delicate. How small does it have to be? Well, in some kind of natural units, it has to be 0.0000, and we could stand here for a long time before I told you that there was 120 zeros and then a 1. In other words, the number 10 to the 120, 10 to the minus 120.
Which I would read as 10,120 or something.
You would read it as 0.00000000, and I don't want to waste your time, and eventually a 1 at the end. No number in physics, no number in any kind of natural science has ever been that small. Physicists have always assumed that if it was that small, it must really be zero. Imagine you measure something. You measure something at the first round, and you find out it's zero to two or three decimal places. You measure it again, and you find out it's zero to four decimal places. You measure it again and again and again and again, and eventually it's zero to 20 decimal places. You're pretty sure that number is probably zero. But then you keep measuring it, and eventually you measure 119 decimal places. Well, any idiot would assume that in the 120th decimal place, that number is going to be zero.
But you can call it, as it's often called, almost zero, right?
Well, it's almost zero, but why is it so close to zero? So physicists, for the most part, people like myself, people like Steven Weinberg, people like Ed Witten, very famous physicists, all assumed that there was something in string theory or something in our best theory which would tell us exactly why this was exactly zero. Well, guess what happened? When it was measured in the 120th decimal place, it wasn't zero. This was like a shot from, I don't know from where, from hell for a physicist, to suddenly discover that a number which had been zero for so many decimal places was not really zero. So we not only had to explain why it wasn't there, we had to explain why it was there.
Yeah. I say call it the greatest blunder of his life.
He did indeed, but it may have been his greatest success too.
Well, this whole idea of a multiple universe rests on the idea of an infinite number, and it really changes the whole way physics is done, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It certainly does. Let me phrase the question for you in a way which I think is probably the least objectionable for most people. We know that the universe is very, very big. We can look out with telescopes, and we can see out to about 10 billion light years. That sounds huge to most people, 10 billion light years. But for an astronomer, it's not very big. It's how far they can see with telescopes. We know the universe is much, much bigger than that. And if you ask me later, I can tell you how we know that the universe is bigger. The universe is much, much bigger than the part that we can see. We also know that there are reasons to believe that the universe is varied, that it varies from place to place. Given that it's all that big and all that variable, we no longer have any reason whatever to believe that our little tiny corner of the universe is representative of the whole thing. In other words, we're now faced with the question, is the universe very big and everywhere's the same, or is it very, very big and sort of a patchwork quilt, a crazy quilt of different environments?
Is it an elegant universe?
Well, this
elegance... about Brian Greene because, you know, he's had so much notoriety as a string theorist.
Yeah. Brian, first of all, is a very good scientist. He is not just a popular writer. He's a very good scientist. Is it an elegant universe? This is in the eye of the beholder. If you look at what we now know about the universe, the standard model of particle physics, it's inelegant as hell.
Patchwork, like you said.
Yeah. It's a patchwork of random numbers with no particular meaning to them. And no, I would say it's very inelegant. Elegant Universe was, of course, a very clever title for a book, but I don't even really think that Brian thinks that what we know about the universe today is really quite as elegant as he would like.
So the Big Bang would be maybe happening over and over and over again in this multiverse?
In this multiverse, the Big Bang would be happening over and over and over again on the huge expanse of the entire so-called multiverse or megaverse, as I like to call it. Every so often, here and there, pop, a little Big Bang would explode, and that Big Bang would become a universe. Each one would be different than the others. Each one would have different properties. In some of them, there would be electrons. In others, there wouldn't be electrons. In the ones where there were no electrons, there wouldn't be any life, because life is dependent on chemistry. Chemistry is dependent on atoms. Atoms need electrons.
As you've pointed out, we don't necessarily need what we think of as constituting our own life. That is, who knows what's out there? It may not need water. It may not need carbon.
Yes, you're perfectly right. So when I say life, I mean life as we know it. Mm-hmm. But I rather think that in most places you couldn't have life. If you look at our ordinary universe, most of space is occupied by just plain empty cold space. The rest of it here and there is occupied by stars, where the temperature is billions of degrees. The rest of it is occupied by planets, which for the most part are terribly cold or terribly hot. My own guess is that life can't exist in the interior of a star. My own guess is that life doesn't exist in cold, cold outer space. So part of the assumption here is that life can only exist in certain kinds of places. Places which are comfortable, places which have oxygen, places which have carbon, places which are warm enough for liquid water to exist, for example, places where electrons can exist, places where chemistry can take place. Could that be wrong? Sure, it could be wrong. This is not really a question for physics. It's a question for biology. How ingenious can biologists be in designing life without the usual constituents of life?
Well, there's the assumption, of course, that there's an ingeniousness that goes into the design of life on this planet. It's called intelligent design, and of course it's received a great deal of controversy, and you kind of take it on here, as I indicated in my introduction. The anthropic principle, in fact, is the key to all this, but I think the way I'm reading you is that it can happen by sheer randomness.
Right. So let me start with life rather than the universe. Life is based on DNA molecules. How many different kinds of DNA molecules are there? Well, a DNA molecule is a string of atoms. Each rung on that string, it's a ladder. Each rung on that ladder can be any one of four base pairs. There are about 1 billion base pairs in a DNA molecule of ordinary life. Do you know how many ways you can put those various constituents together to make a life form? The number is 4 to the billion. This is a huge, huge number. This is the number of possible designs of life, the number of possible different ways that a DNA molecule can be assembled. With that many possibilities, some small fraction of them are going to be intelligent. Most of them won't be. Most of them won't work at all. Most of these designs won't even work and won't even be alive. Some tiny fraction of them might be alive, but will be bacterium. Of those, some tinier fraction might be vertebrates, and some even tinier fraction, excuse me, might have brains. Yes, there are some tiny fraction of the living creatures that can sit here and ask the question, why am I here? Most of them can't. Why are we the ones that can sit here and ask the question? Apart from the fact that I have a cough, we are the ones who can sit here and ask the question, because if we weren't the ones who could sit here and ask the question, we wouldn't. It's as simple as that. Those who can ask, do ask.
Those who can ask, do ask. That kind of sums it all up, doesn't it? But it all seems to... We were talking before we went on the air about Stephen Jay Gould, who sees the whole evolution process as being sort of a design, and yet a design that happens by randomness. And to some extent, I think what you're saying about our own cosmic place here is it all comes down to that kind of what seems like design, but by randomness.
Yes, just a huge number of possibilities, an enormous number of possibilities for a universe, and in some very, very small fraction of them happen to be put together in a way that life can exist. Period. End of story. There is no more.
But what about intelligent design? How do we disprove the notion that that's an... Or how do we prove that it's an illusion, for that matter?
How do we prove that... Well, we could, for example, ask... I won't use a particular name for the designer. Let's just call him the designer. We could ask...
M might work.
How does M intervene? Can we get M to intervene? So we create an enormous number of electrons. We can do this in the laboratory up at SLAC, create an enormous number, and we can then get 1,000 people to sit there and pray as hard as they can. Please, dear M, let one of these electrons fly off in some wrong direction. With 1,000 prayers, we should be able to get one electron. We should be able to get M to be able to deflect one electron in the wrong direction. It doesn't happen. So, as far as we can tell as scientists, the world always works according to scientific principles.
But you haven't taken all these people and had them pray together yet, have you?
Oh, I have. Of course I have. We do this in Stanford all the time.
Actually, speaking about things you do at Stanford, is there a kind of, well, you mentioned this in your book early on, a split between cosmology and physics? And
no.
Some of it bitter, supposedly? You know?
No.
Not at all.
At Stanford?
No, I don't mean at Stanford. I mean generally. In terms of the scientific community or in terms of...
I would say that most cosmologists, for the most part, share my view. There has been a split with physicists. This split is not really a split anymore. It's not a substantive split anymore. It's not that some physicists believe one thing and another set of physicists believe another thing. Just about every really bright, well-thought-of physicist now understands that this landscape, this multiverse, is a serious issue, has to be dealt with, could be right. Not just that it could be right, that of all the things that we've put together, it's the most likely to be right. The controversy, if it is that, is one over emotional response. How do you respond to this fact? Some people, like my friend Ed Witten, for example, are frightened by it. They're not frightened personally. It doesn't bother them personally. They are frightened that it might spell the end of physics as a predictive science. If there are just too many possibilities, it might become impossible to predict with science. Another of my very good friends, David Gross, worries that young people might stop looking for other kinds of answers. Instead of asking why the cosmological constant is as tiny as it is, our answer is it's as tiny as it is because you couldn't live in a place where it was any bigger. He worries that young people will stop looking for the other kind of answer. He may be right. This may be something to worry about. Ed may also be right. It may be something there. But notice that none of them are arguing against it in a scientific way. They're worried about it. The other faction is not worried about it. They find it exciting. They find the same set of ideas exciting. They find this a new kind of Copernicanism, if you like. The world is much bigger than we thought, much more diverse than we thought, and much more pregnant with possibility. So it's much, much more, at least among the higher-ups in physics, I would say, it's much, much more a question of psychological reaction to what people think is likely to be true and what they hope is true. Ed, for example, Witten, will say, yes, this looks like the most likely possibility, but hope springs eternal. By that he means he can always hope that some other explanation will come along in the future. So that's the nature of the controversy.
Talking again with Leonard Susskind, his book is The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. Some who have taken you on, one of your critics, for example, a Washington Times reporter and reviewer who has a physics pedigree, says, you're willing to abandon that nature follows one set of laws, a principle upon which modern science was founded, to expunge the idea of a creator designing the universe.
Well, I certainly don't think a creator designed the universe, so I'm not sure what he's talking about. I do believe there's one set of laws. It's kind of like asking, trying to calculate the temperature of a planet. Well, if you didn't know any better, and we lived on this planet, our planet, and we couldn't see out beyond the cloud bank, we might ask the question, why is the temperature of the Earth what it is? Why does the temperature of the Earth lie between boiling and freezing? At some point, we might give up and say, well, maybe that's not the right question. Maybe there are a lot of planets out there. Maybe there are many, many different diverse environments out there, and maybe we just live on the kind of diverse environment that permits life. The same people would have come along and said, they're giving up. They're giving up. They're giving up the quest to understand why the temperature is 25 degrees or whatever it is in whatever units. There are some times, you know, the field of physics is littered with the bodies of old men who didn't know when to give up.
On that note, we're coming up on the break here. We're talking to Leonard Susskind. Let me give you a phone number. If you'd like to join us, please do. We welcome your calls, and you can do that now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, number for your calls, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or join us by email with any questions or comments you might have. Email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with David Susskind. Yeah, right. With Leonard Susskind. I knew that might happen. Like 10,500. Author of The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. And Professor Susskind was being very complimentary about my preparation and programs, but I told him this is one where the guest is infinitely more knowledgeable than his interlocutor in numbers that can't even be measured. Here's an email from a listener who says, Professor Susskind will join Cal physicist Rafael Busso in a free public dialogue on string theory quite soon. It will be part of Wunderfest, the Bay Area Festival of Science, which happens at Stanford and Cal on the first weekend of every November. Suskind and Busso will address Is the World Made of Strings at Stanford on Saturday, November 4th, and details available at www.wonderfest.org.
And I'll tell you the truth. I don't at the moment know exactly what I'll say.
That's typical of public events for me as well. However, you've done a real, I think, yeoman job here of putting things in perspective in a lay fashion that the public can really understand about some very difficult concepts. I mean, this is in the spirit of somebody like Stephen Jay Gould. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
Yeah. As long as we're passing the bouquets back and forth, we'll go to our callers, though, before we go to your emails, and let's bring Tim on first. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dr. Siskind. I'm about a chapter away from finishing a book. It's wonderful. The question I have relates to the cosmological constant and the Big Bang. It's really more the Big Bang than anything. I'm wondering why, with all the energy and mass of the universe, why we didn't just collapse into one big black hole. Is the constant large enough to have caused the bang and the inflation?
No. No, it wasn't really the cosmological constant which caused the bang and the inflation. Think of it this way. Originally, the universe, for reasons that we don't completely know, the original universe was kind of shot out of a cannon in all directions simultaneously. The inertia of that cannon being shot out is what carried things out. Now, if there was only ordinary gravity, gravity might have turned things around and caused them to recollapse. If there is also the outward cosmological constant, it will help them to keep going. But it was, in a sense, the original inertia of the blast which carried them out to begin with. Why that blast happened in the very beginning, that is still beyond us.
I see. So the inertia is really the question. How could it have overcome the total energy and mass of such a concentrated universe? It should have been a black hole, shouldn't it?
Just in exactly the same way that a rocket shot from the surface of the Earth might be able to overcome the gravity of the surface of the Earth. If it's not shot hard enough, it'll fall back. If it's shot hard enough, it'll keep going. In the same way, the same possibilities for the universe. If it's shot out from its own cannon hard enough, it can keep going. If it's not shot out hard enough, it will collapse back and fall in on itself.
So does string theory have any way of addressing what happens at these very early moments of the universe?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Tim, for the call. I'm not going to give things away here, but he said he has read everything but the final chapter, and in the concluding chapter, you talk about sort of no other side. But string theory really, again, has nothing incontrovertible behind it, no real evidence to support or verify it, does it? I say that because, just by the way, just to tell, here's a listener says, there's no more evidence for string theory than there is for intelligent design, correct? I'm no fan of intelligent design, but I wonder how the string theorists are getting away with this.
I think you have to be, to a certain extent, a physicist to understand what string theory has done. One of the things that string theory has done is that it has unified in a completely unique way. There is no competition. The idea of quantum mechanics with gravity. Will it ultimately be the only version of quantum mechanics and gravity? We don't really know. But at the moment, it's the one direction that we have where we can see gravity and quantum mechanics coexisting in the same kind of theory.
The only theory that allows
that. It's the only theory that allows that. And we really don't have any choice but to follow through on it. It's not as though we had a choice. Somebody presents you, however it got there, with a possible theory that has the various ingredients that you're looking for. Can you afford to just say, let's put this down because we don't have proof of it yet? No, that would be really stupid. We have to follow it through. We have to find out what it says. And we have to find out if it says the things that we actually do see in the real world. More and more, the things that string theory seems to say seem to jibe and coexist with the things that cosmologists and physicists see in the laboratory. Is there a proof of it? No, there isn't. There is also no proof that intelligent design is wrong. I would be the last one to say that intelligent design has been proved to be wrong. I would be the first to say that we ought to look for other explanations first.
Well, here's another explanation from a listener named Richard who says, question for Leonard Susskind. Do you ascribe to the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics? Do you think the universe multiverse is a single entangled whole? Are there many Leonard Susskinds out there? Are they you? Are you aware of them? And if not, why not?
I think that listener probably knows more than he's letting on. I wouldn't be surprised if he was a physicist.
And Tim is our next caller from Davis. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess it's been postulated that gravity is multidimensional. That is, it's outside of our normal three dimensions. Is it possible that light is also multidimensional? And if so, would that explain some of the odd quantum characteristics of light?
No. The idea is that there are more dimensions to space, but most of them, the ones that we can't see, are very, very tiny. The gravitational force, we imagine, does travel through these extra dimensions, but these extra dimensions are so tiny, so small, that for all practical purposes, they only travel through our ordinary dimensions. Most of the theories of light have light traveling on what is called a brain embedded in these higher dimensions. So most of the theories of light have light traveling in three dimensions and gravity traveling in higher dimensions. But it really doesn't matter that much if these dimensions are very, very small, because they're so small that you really can't get off them, so to speak. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. I'll look more into it, and I'll also look up your book. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you, Tim, for the call. Good to hear from you. So how did you go from plumbing to physics?
Well, my father was a plumber. I was a plumber. I actually worked as a plumber for about 5 years in the South Bronx. I never liked it very much. What we called plumbing, incidentally, was a mix of plumbing and sewer cleaning. And plumbing, incidentally, in the South Bronx was a very different occupation than plumbing in Palo Alto. As far as I can tell, Palo Alto plumbers come to work in tuxedos.
My father used to call plumbers doctors. He said, with what you charge, you deserve the title. Yeah.
But you didn't live in the lower
Cleveland,
Bronx.
Ohio, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So we came in overalls, a watch cap, and a pair of hard boots, and it was tough. It was hard work. I didn't like it very much. My father had the idea to send me to college to become an engineer. The idea was we would go into heating engineering together. So I took a few courses. The first were physics and mathematics, and I found out I was really good at it. And then came the first engineering course. The first engineering course was on mechanical drawing. Now, in those days, we didn't have computers, and we actually had to make drawings. And a drawing was done with an invention of the devil. It was called a ruling pen. You know what a ruling pen is?
Yes, I do.
It was a real invention of the devil. It had two little nibs, and you suspended the ink, the India ink, between the two little nibs, and you hoped and you prayed that it wouldn't form a blob on your drawing. And I wasn't any good at it. Every drawing I would make would have a number of blobs on it, and it would be turned back by the professor saying, "This is no good. You've blobbed your drawing." So after most of the semester, the professor, Harold Rothbart, came to me and he said, "Susskind, I'm going to fail you in this course. You can't do engineering. You're not good at it. You make blobs." And I said, "Professor, I can't afford to fail. I'm married. I have a kid. My father's waiting for me. We got to be heating engineers. I got to get to work. You can't fail me." And he said, "Look, I'll pass you under one circumstance. The circumstance is that you drop out of engineering." "Drop out of engineering? I can't drop out of engineering." He said, "You can drop out of engineering. You're a very smart kid. You should be a scientist." Well, at the time, I didn't know what a scientist was, and I figured this is some guy in a white lab coat with test tubes. So I went to the chemistry department, and the chemistry department said, "Nope, can't do it. You haven't taken enough chemistry." I tried the math department. "Nope, not enough math." Finally, last hope was the physics department.
And thus was a physicist born. That's a great story. Let me go to more of your calls here. Ray, join us. Hi.
It sounds like maybe the genesis of a good Monty Python sketch. Thanks for that story. You know, when we think of ourselves living day by day in this universe with which we're familiar, it's a convention to think of the minutes passing by and the days and the years. But one wonders if when you were describing the Big Bang or any number of Big Bangs, if time might not be different from the day-by-day succession of uniform units, the kind of granulated time with which we're familiar, and maybe time doesn't even exist in some universes. Can you make some sort of observations on this?
I can make the observation that in many respects we're confused about time for very much the reasons that you say. If the universe does consist, or the megaverse or the multiverse does consist of many parts which are in some sense disconnected from each other and which can't communicate with each other, does it make sense to ascribe to them the same time, the same kind of timekeeping? Can there be clocks which keep time simultaneously in all these different parts of the universe? And most of us think that the answer is no, that there's no universal concept of time that covers the whole multiverse. So in that sense, I would have to say that time is a provisional concept that we use in our corner of the universe and which eventually we will have to modify and eventually we will have to understand much better.
Getting a picture in my mind, you know those dolly clocks that are melting?
The dolly clocks that are melting,
That's kind of right in my head
right.
As you're talking.
Right.
And thank Ray for his call. Somebody called and wanted to know, are you doing the public lecture course you generally do at Stanford this year?
I do every year.
So you'll be doing it again.
Yeah.
Here's another question from a listener named Robert. Isn't the assumption that somehow the universe was created, especially for humans, besides being incredibly egoistic, just plain backwards? Is putting one's eye at the wrong end of the telescope after billions of years we have... It's putting one's eye, at the wrong end of the telescope. After billions of years, we have simply evolved to fit the universe we live in. Does the Earth's atmosphere contain this particular mixture of gases because someone wants us to be able to breathe, or do we breathe this mixture of gases because this is what our ancestors found and the ones that couldn't breathe died out? Anyway, if there is an intelligent design, I want to check the warranty on knees, lower backs, and eyes.
Right.
And here's another listener, Tim, who says, he's close to finishing your book and says, wonderful, with 3 exclamation marks. Question for you, though. Would not the mass energy of the early universe have prevented the Big Bang and inflation? In other words, I'm confused as to how the universe could have been born instead of becoming a black hole instead. Another way of stating the question, is a repulsive force sufficient to overcome the gravity of all the mass energy of the universe?
This is exactly the same question that the first person asked. And it's a good question. It's a very good question. The answer will be the same.
Ditto.
Should I answer it, or should we
actually, it is okay, the same question. Right. It was phrased a different way. Here's a different question, though. I'd love to know how physicists calculate that there isn't enough visible matter in the universe, so dark matter must make up the difference. How do they know that all the missing mass isn't residing in as yet undetected black holes?
Very, very good question.
Yeah.
By undetected black holes, people usually mean black holes that were made out of stars. Stars are made out of protons and neutrons, ordinary stars. So ultimately, if you trace back far enough, those black holes would have been protons and neutrons before they collapsed to form black holes. Now, we do know an awful lot from the very early universe and the formation of the early elements, in particular, hydrogen and helium, about how many protons and neutrons there were to begin with. And if we were to ascribe all of the missing mass to black holes, which were originally made up out of protons and neutrons, we would have had too many protons and neutrons in the early universe to account for the elements as we know them.
But didn't you have a kind of a debate with Stephen Hawking about what happens to black holes or the information that goes into black holes?
Yes, I did, but it wasn't that particular debate.
Went on for about 20 years, as I understand.
Indeed. I'm writing a book about it.
That's the next book.
Yeah.
Can string theory explain what happened before the Big Bang? Also, is there proof that the universe is finite in length? If so, then what's beyond our universe? My head hurts.
Not the only one. At the moment, string theory cannot address what happened before the Big Bang, or even if the concept of before the Big Bang makes sense.
But intelligent design can.
Intelligent design can, right. string theory cannot. And I don't want to take up intelligent design on this program anyway. String theory cannot.
What about this from another listener named Alan? Every time I think we've got it figured out, or at least getting close, a new theory pops up. Today, string theory. Tomorrow, holographic universe. Thursday, something else. Will we ever have a grip on what's going on and when?
We don't know.
Good answer. Let's go to our...
We don't know.
Billy, thanks for waiting. You're on. Morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I want to go back to something you mentioned to you earlier about intelligent design theory and the question of whether you disagree with it or not. And I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong here, that you think that other things should be explored first. Is that correct?
I did say that.
You're right. There's a Vedic tradition, and maybe you're aware of this, that actually talks in a different language where they use physics or somewhat loosely physics concepts, and they also use terms of consciousness, which kind of lends or sounds a little bit like intelligent design theory or some basis of it. I'm wondering if you consider the fact that possibly we're simply just taking two different angles on the same puzzle and using different language. One from intelligent design theorists maybe talking in terms of consciousness or the psychology of the universe, and on the other side talking in terms of pure physics and those mechanics that derive from that. Is that what we're talking about here, or are you...
I sympathize with that view, but let me say for myself, the question was, can we explain the universe on the grounds of absolutely traditional statistics, mathematics, and traditional ideas about the way that that matter works and so forth? Can we explain things without having to go to some new Vedic or other kind of mystical, I'll call it mystical, and I'm not, don't take it as pejorative, some other kind of mystical input? Can we explain the universe on the basis of more conventional ideas of statistics, large numbers, randomness, and so forth? It seems to me that we can. Now, is that the only explanation? That remains to be seen.
Let me thank the caller. So how do we know the universe is getting bigger?
We know that it's getting bigger because we see the parts of it moving apart. Mm-hmm. We see the distant stars moving apart. But I think there was another question. How do we know that it's very much bigger than the part that we can see?
Mm-hmm.
All right. The answer goes something like this. Supposing you are on a field, out in the field, an ordinary field, a soccer field, and you had no idea how big the whole Earth was. You could start doing some measurements on the soccer field. Those measurements could be surveying, measuring triangles, measuring the angles of triangles, and so forth. You would do some very careful measurements, and you would find that the field had Euclidean geometry. It behaved triangles, the sums of the angles added up to 180 degrees. It had all of the properties of flat space. Right? That tells you one thing, that if the universe is curved, if the Earth is curved and finite, it's very much bigger than the portion that you can see. Same thing is true of the universe. It looks very flat. Because it looks so flat, it must be very big. So how big? We know that it's at least 10 times bigger than the part that we can see.
Actually, we think it's curved, don't we? I mean, you do.
We do think it's curved.
Do, yeah,
we do think it's curved.
Get more calls on for you. Martin, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I'm curious. What is the role? I mean, we're talking about the universe and strings and everything that's playing out in multiple dimensions. What's the role of human intention or the mind or our thoughts to affect that which is playing out in these dimensions and showing up in our real world? Is there any connection between what's going on in our mind and our ability to manifest things and create stuff in reality?
Not in the version, let's call it the anthropic principle, not in the version of the anthropic principle that's in my book or that most physicists believe in. Most physicists who believe in these ideas believe the world is the way it is for a collection of random accidents plus the fact that we can only live where we can live. There's no concept of intention, no concept that we willed the universe or anything like that. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily the bottom line to the whole thing, but that is the hypothesis that's out in front of us now.
Let me thank the caller and go to an emailer who says, I'm a high school physics teacher who recently told the students about the virtues of the cosmic landscape, the concept, and the book. A particularly thoughtful student asked what the evidence is for the existence of these many, many universes. Can we, in fact, get real evidence for the existence of other universes, or do we only have strong arguments for this multiverse? What am I to tell my student?
We can't, we probably never will and never can get direct evidence for these universes very, very far from us in space. But what we can and may be able to get is a picture of what happened in the past, that our universe evolved by a series of events from other kinds of universes. Looking back deep, deep into the past, we may be able to discover that our universe made transitions from one kind of universe to another kind of universe to another kind of universe.
In fact, wouldn't it mean if we're curved that we could have come out of another universe?
Yes, that's exactly right. If the universe is curved in the right way, it would give us some inkling that we came out of another universe, as you say, that we were a small bubble in another kind of universe. So while it's true that we can't get direct evidence of things that are sufficiently far from us, we can get direct evidence about things which are sufficiently far into our past. And those things could very well look like different universes.
Leonard Susskind, again, is professor of physics at Stanford and the author of The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. And, Paul, let's get you on here. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi. I just want to bring up a point here and maybe offer it as a question. If we have an infinite universe, there's no need for the cosmological constant because everything is uniform throughout. And, of course, that was the basis of the steady-state universe that we still are hearing about at this time, but not as energetically as in the past. So what would you say to that? And by the way, I want to say these multi-universes, who's to say each galaxy isn't kind of similar to a multi-universe?
Well, it is. But they happen to all be characteristically very similar to each other. They have the same laws of electromagnetism. They have the same laws of gravity. So they're all very similar to each other, not as dissimilar as we might like in the multiverse. But again, your question, repeat the question.
Well, I'm just saying, if we have an infinite universe, yes. There's no need for cosmological constants.
No. You're mixing up things. Not so. We need the cosmological constant because we've detected it. It exists. We've measured it. The universe may well be infinite, and the two don't have to do with each other.
If we didn't have a cosmological constant, we wouldn't have the universe, I think, is the answer.
I think that's true. I think that's true.
And we go to more of your calls. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Susskind. I'd like to know what your attitude is about the theory loop quantum gravity.
It's an immature theory in the sense...
What is it? I mean, can we put it in lay terms?
Yeah. What is it? It's a theory in which space and time are composed of loops of energy, similar to string theory, but not quite the same. I would say it's a half-baked theory. Now, I don't mean anything terrible by that. Half-baked means it's not completely baked. It has not had the kind of mathematical success and mathematical consistency that string theory has had. Even the proponents of it hope that what they will find is that it's another way of expressing string theory. They're all over the map on what they believe and what they don't believe. And I would have to say that it's a work in progress which really hasn't gelled together yet. Could it be part of the story? Yes, it could be part of the story. Is it now part of the story? Not as far as I can tell.
Here's a listener named Mike who says, can you cite any published experimental results that support the major contentions of string theory?
Yes. Oh, the major contentions of string theory. Yes, the existence of gravity, the existence of particles, the...
laws of the universe.
The laws of the universe. But going beyond that, the same strings seen through a funny microscope are also protons and neutrons. They're also the stringy objects that make up protons and neutrons. We know a lot about protons, neutrons, and mesons. they behave like strings. This is where string theory came from in the first place. It came from the theory of protons and neutrons. It was invented by Nambu and myself in 1969 as a theory of protons and neutrons. It's an extremely successful theory of protons and neutrons.
But the envisioning, actually, you credit to Feynman.
No, not of string theory.
No. I mean, in terms of just laying out the principles upon which this was all envisioned. This is all visualized.
Not string theory itself, but the forerunners of string theory.
We're going back, yeah.
The forerunners of string theory, quantum field theory, the ability to visualize these things went back to Feynman. That's right. String theory itself has had major successes. The whole explanation of protons, neutrons, the whole explanation of nuclear physics. In modern times, nuclear physics has been called quantum chromodynamics. Quantum chromodynamics is a string theory. The modern nuclear physics experiments called heavy ion collisions are best described in terms of string theory. They're best described in terms of black holes, string theory, the whole works. So it is just wrong to say that it hasn't had major successes. It has. The people who would like to think that it didn't have major successes like to ignore those successes. They like to define success as that which supports their argument.
Well, I think your book is headed for major success, and I'm glad we had the chance to sort of dip into it here today. Again, Leonard Susskind's book is called The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. Delighted that you could be here with us.
Thank you, Michael.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is presented in the evening, 10 to 11 as well. We'll be with you tomorrow if all goes according to plan. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., Kevin Guillory, and Laura Mall. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.